First scripture reading is Matthew 15, verses 21 to 28. In this section of Matthew's gospel, Jesus has been debating with the Pharisees and scribes. The Pharisees had added certain regulations that were not part of the Torah, the law, but which, they argued, were intended to help people keep the law. One of these regulations was about washing one's hands before one eats. This was a ritual washing and not based on our understanding of germs. Jesus takes his argument to his followers and takes it a step further to say that the dietary laws set out in Torah are not essential, since they make a person unclean is not what goes in the mouth, but what comes out of the mouth. By challenging the dietary laws this way, Jesus challenges the major barriers of inclusion of the Gentiles, non-Jews. With exquisite timing, the Gentile Canaanite woman then bursts onto the scene. Matthew 15, verses 21 to 28, reading from the New International Version. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." The woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Yes, it is, Lord," she said. "Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus said to her, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed at that moment. We are now going to sing Psalm 63. And it is not the version that's in Voices United. And Gina is going to lead us through this psalm, which is sung in its entirety. Gina.
Well, let's begin with prayer, shall we? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our strength and our Redeemer and our joy. Amen. Well, Will and I were talking on the phone about what I might do today, because the idea was to be able to talk to you about the men's work that I've been doing, and yet to somehow tie that into what you folks have been doing here throughout the course of Lent. So the theme is, as you know, if you've been around the last couple of weeks, is letting go, right? Letting go, dot, 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 and then what are we taking up as we're letting go of things? And so we settled on this theme, or this title, Letting Go, Being Ourselves. Because what I want to do is have us reflect on how the ways in which, and I'm going to talk about gender, but I think it applies to this story from Matthew as well, the ways in which our culture shapes us so that it is more difficult for us to be the people whom God has really made us to be, right? Because we're busy acting out these stereotypes, these ways of being. So how do we let go and gain the freedom to be the people whom God has truly made us to be? I'm going to be talking about gender, I'm going to be talking about men, but I think a lot of what I'm saying, I hope, is going to apply to women as well. So those of you who are not men, which generally speaking in United Church congregations is the vast majority, I hope that you can find yourself somewhere in here, that you can hear your own story somewhere in this story. So the story begins, and I actually want to back up a bit and begin a bit before where Deborah began reading today. The story, let's start the story with Jesus having been on the hills on the northern end of the Sea of Galilee, and he has been teaching. He's been teaching for a long time, and he's got what we call the Sermon on the Mount from Matthew's Gospel. And the people are hungry, and he says to his followers, well, give them something to eat. And they say, that's crazy. There's thousands of them. We can't afford to feed them all. He says, just give them something to eat. And you know the story of the feeding of the, and they say 5,000, but that was only the men, right? So you got the women and the children. So thousands and thousands of people are fed. And do you remember, here's your first question, your first test. How many baskets of leftovers were gathered after the feeding of the 5,000? Do you remember? Oh, you guys are good. I don't know, it was over here somewhere. 12 baskets. Now, I'm thinking that's probably a metaphor for the 12 tribes of Israel, right? So there is enough left over for all the people of Israel. Okay, hang on to that. Now, Jesus leaves, and he goes, as the text tells us, up to the country of Tyre and Sidon, which is north, up on the coast, out of the land of Israel. He's in Gentile territory. And the story that Deborah read for us unfolds. The Canaanite woman comes. She asks for this miracle, for this healing. He says, go away, you're not worthy of this. She calls him on it, and he gives her what she asks for. Now, generally speaking, there's two ways the story has been interpreted over the years. You know, there's two kinds of people in the world. There's people who say there's two kinds of people in the world, and people who don't. Well, there's two ways of reading this story historically. One is that Jesus knew all along what was going on because Jesus was God, and so he was really just testing her, and he didn't really mean the nasty things he said. The second version, which is the one, the second understanding, which is the one I mentioned with the children a few minutes ago, is that Jesus actually learns from the Canaanite woman something about what God's reign really is about, so that he's challenged, he's stretched, he is enhanced by his encounter with this fierce and faithful woman. And what's interesting is that the next story after this, which we don't get when we read the gospel in church, because we read little chunks, right? When this was written, it was meant to be listened to, and to listen to the whole thing from beginning to end, so you get the broader picture. So the story after this is Jesus goes back down to the Galilee, and this time he goes across the Jordan, which means he's in Gentile territory, and he does healing and teaching. And then what happens at the end of the day? The people are hungry. He tells his followers, give them something to eat. Does this sound familiar? They all eat. And how much is gathered up at the end? You guys are good. 7 baskets. Now, what's interesting is that people in those days often thought or talked about the 7 nations of the world, the 7 nations outside of Israel. And I wonder if the story isn't somehow telling us about how Jesus moves from understanding a fairly narrow, constrained sense of his mission to the people of Israel, because of his encounter with a Canaanite woman, to a broader vision of his mission, which encompasses everyone, the Gentiles as well. One of the core beliefs that at Manifest, the men's work that I'm doing, that we hold is that the dominant forms of masculinity, and remember, if you can, maybe you can read femininity into this as well, but the dominant forms of masculinity, think of every masculine stereotype you can, are not serving us very well. They don't serve men, they don't serve women, they don't serve society, and they don't serve the planet or her ecosystems. And you may be familiar with some of the statistics, or you maybe have heard them in passing and have some vague sense of the sobering reality that when we're talking about suicide, when we're talking about victims and perpetrators of violent crime, when we're talking about workplace deaths, when we're talking about incarceration, when we're talking about shorter life expectancy, we're talking about men. At the same time, there's also lots of evidence emerging around, on average, lower marks in school, lower university admissions rates, lower graduation rates. There's 100 ways to dissect and parse and analyze such numbers, but what they seem to point to is that males in our culture, more than females, struggle and underperform as positive contributing members of society. And at the same time, they exact a disproportionate demand on our society's resources. So that was part of what motivated me or interested me in this work to begin with. Now, I'm one of those who believes that while sex characteristics are something that each of us is born with, and there's even exceptions to that, gender is something that we're taught. It's something that's laid on us from the time that we are born, when boys tend to be treated one way and girls tend to be treated another. I remember when my oldest was born, and we would dress her, Emma, in blue or green or, I don't know, something like that. And this is when she's, you know, and people in the church knew, but other people didn't know, and they'd see this cute little baby in the car seat, and they'd say, "Is it a boy or a girl?" I think, does it matter? Well, yeah, actually, it does matter. It really matters. We need to know, and we treat children from the time they are infants differently, based on what we know about primary sex characteristics. So gender obscures the similarities between men and women, right? It says that men and women are different. Well, in some ways we are, but there's actually a lot more similarities than there are differences. And there's as wide a group of differences within those who would identify as men and those who would identify as women, as there are between, right? So we obscure the similarities and we emphasize the differences. And it leaves us thinking that the image of masculinity and the image of femininity that we grew up with represent our biological essence. It is who we are. Now, in terms of masculinity, each ethnic and social group builds its own definition. And those if you think about this just over the course of your lifetimes, or if you've come from another culture, or if you've traveled, spent time in another culture, you'll know that different cultures conceive of masculinity and femininity differently. And within those kind of popular definitions, there are many who don't fit. Right? The same is probably true of femininity. What appears to be different, though, is this, that for most men, whatever our ideas of masculinity are, they combine to create a mask, a shell that protects us against the fear of not being manly. Women, ask a man you know well enough about this. Ask about the fear of not appearing to be manly enough. particularly if you know guys in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s. So that many men invest a great deal in keeping up the appearance of what is really a fairly fragile facade, that I'm different because I'm a man, right? And that means I have to be certain things and I can't be certain other things. And again, I want to suggest that that facade is not, generally speaking, often, not always, but often, is not healthy. And we have choices when we help to construct the gender of our children. To tell a little boy who is crying that big boys don't cry is a choice, and believe me, it still happens. And the same goes for telling a girl that her main role model for adulthood is a princess whose principal goal in life is landing a prince. And little girls get that message all the time. Right? That's a choice that we make about what it means to be a girl. So if those who say gender is largely created are correct, then we all have a choice at some level about how we will express our gender, male, female, somewhere in between. And so we can ask ourselves, what does it mean for me to be a man? What does it mean for me to be a woman? And how much is the way that I act out my manhood or my womanhood based on social scripts that I feel pressured to live up to and live out? And how much is a genuine expression of who I really am? How much of Jesus' initial attitude toward the Canaanite woman was based on what he had been taught as a little boy about who Jews are and who Gentiles are and how we live differently? Even though on some level intellectually he gets it, right? He's just argued that the food laws that separate Jews and Gentiles shouldn't apply. Even though he gets it intellectually, on some cellular level, has he been encouraged to see himself different from this woman because of their, where they come from? I don't know, but it seems at least possible. Take the example of emotions. So dominant expressions of masculinity are typically concerned with being aggressive as opposed to passive. This is a huge generality, which I'm not going to go into. Buy me a coffee sometime and we'll talk about it. But the passive is feminine, the active is masculine. And men must be active and women, and not be passive, because that would mean they were being feminine. And when it comes to emotions, that means that for many men, there are only two what we might call passive or negative emotions that aren't passive: anger and apathy. And ask yourself about how many men you know have fairly easy access to the emotion of anger or the emotion of apathy, to the extent that apathy is an emotion. The dominant, culturally acceptable masculinities most boys learn include some version of big boys don't cry. Real men cannot be afraid, sad, lonely, confused. Now, we all know, and probably most, maybe all of the men in this room don't apply in these categories. So I'm talking larger than us. And you can think for yourselves to what extent you identify with this. But there's a lot of men out there, believe me, there's a lot of men out there who don't have access. If they feel lonely or sad or confused or anything like that, they can't express it, because that would be unmanly. It's not an ontological description of what it means to be a man, any more than nurturing or sensitive is an ontological description of what it means to be a woman, right? And you might be surprised at the strong influence this has for many men, for many men. We see one of two things. They either genuinely don't have the language for what they're feeling, if it's not anger. They don't know what to call it. They don't know how to talk about it. Or they know what it is, and they're not comfortable talking about it, especially with other men. They will talk about it with, if they're married to a woman, they will often talk about it with a woman. But they won't generally speaking, talk about it with other men. Last Sunday, I met with a men's group I facilitate over in the North Shore, and we started meeting in the fall. We meet once a month. And some were saying that we wished we'd go a little deeper with our conversations. We start off doing some evaluation, you know, how's it going so far? How are you feeling about, you know, the work we've been doing and the discussions we're having? And they wanted to go a little bit deeper. I said, well, it's interesting you'd say that, because I actually thought tonight that we would go a little bit deeper. I said, what is your deepest fear? What is it that you are most afraid of? This is seven guys. One is 40-something. The rest are all 60 and up, some in their 70s. Sorry, two in their 40s. The others are in their 60s and 70s. And we had a great conversation. We talked about what we're most afraid of. We talked about what we've learned, what we know about our fear, about how to dance with our fear. We had a great conversation. And at the end of the meeting, excuse me, when we were checking in, saying how it had been, they all really enjoyed the conversation, and several of them said that they had never talked about their fears with other men before. Never talked about their fears with other men before. Some had, but some hadn't. And man, they were juiced. Like, they were really vibrating. This was great. So part of what I'm doing at Manifest is getting men talking to each other about these kinds of real things, gradually, safely, and there are some powerful conversations that happen. Now, do you suppose there might be a correlation between the dominant expression of masculinity, including the acceptable expression of anger, but not sadness or fear on the one hand, and the statistics I mentioned earlier about men as the primary perpetrators and victims of violence on the other? Like, do you think those two might have some kind of a connection? Do you think that maybe if men were able to talk about fear and sadness and those kinds of things, if they had some other option other than anger to go to, that maybe some of the violent acting out wouldn't happen? It seems to me at least to be a plausible possibility. Now, what about for those of you who are women? Are there dominant, culturally acceptable expressions of femininity that you have taken on? Not because they really reflect who you are, but because you somehow felt or feel that this is what you must do to be a good woman. And if you can remember a time in your past when you were more susceptible to that, maybe you've grown through that, maybe you've worked through that, can you think of younger women you know who are still in that place? And for the men, perhaps it's not emotional literacy and expression, maybe you got that one down, but maybe there's something else in the past or in the present that's got your number. Something else, some other mask that you've been wearing that obscures the real and authentic you, that doesn't allow you to be flexible in how you respond, as flexible in how you respond as you could be. Right? What are the things you know and ignore anyway? Because that's just what you have to do, or what you feel you have to do. What is the cost that you have paid for pretending to be someone or something you weren't? If Jesus indeed learns from the Canaanite woman in this text that God's kingdom is bigger and more encompassing than he'd first dreamed, what might we learn about our deepest and most authentic selves? About how our deepest and most authentic selves are bigger and more nuanced than the dominant cultural scripts that give us messages about how we are and are not to behave. What might we have to learn during the season of Lent, the season of letting go? Of letting go of certain things so that there is space to take on something new, something more life-giving. What might we learn during Lent about letting go of someone else's story for our life so that we can live more fully God's story for our life? I'll leave you with that. Thank you for listening. We are going to be treated to some Mendelssohn.